Welcome to Frank Reactions, the podcast where we help you profit from the digital era through better customer experiences online and off. My name is Temma Frank. Today, I am thrilled to bring Jay Baer back on the show. It's the first time I've had a repeat guest. I love Jay's last book called Utility, spelled Y-O-U-T-I-L-I-T-Y. And if you didn't get to hear my podcast interview with him on that one, go check it out. It's at frankreactions.com/36. Today, he's here to talk about his new book, Hug Your Haters, which ties in very nicely with my new book, People Shock. And I have been a fan of Jay's for so long. I was totally thrilled when he, after seeing some of the book, actually volunteered a fantastic review for People Shock. So thank you, Jay. Anyway, today's interview is a little bit longer than usual, but I think you will find, as I did, that time listening to Jay just flies by. He's got so many great stories and a really great way of putting things. But if you start listening and you run out of time to hear the whole thing, we will, of course, have a transcript ready and available to you on the site for download by Wednesday evening. I'm not going to take more time in the lead-in because I want to get right to it. Chat with you briefly after the interview.
Hi, this is Jay Baer. I'm the president of Convince and Convert, author of 5 books, including the new Hug Your Haters and the most retweeted person in the world among digital marketers.
Cool. Congratulations on that. You also are the author of Utility, which I've interviewed you on previously. Thought it was a wonderful book, and I often do cite that book, actually, in some of the examples.
Oh, very nice of you. Thank you.
So your new book is something that's near and dear to my heart. As you know, I've also got a book coming out on a related theme about customer experience. And I want to start with the issue of trolls, because you call your book Hug Your Haters, and you made the comment, haters aren't your problem, ignoring them is. And yet there are some haters who really are just virulent and vicious. So should you really be hugging all your haters?
I think yes. I think everybody deserves to be responded to. I do not think that customers are always right. I think that customers should always be listened to.
Right.
Even the vitriolic and what I call them in the book, the crazies, you know, there are certainly some of those out there. Now, let's acknowledge that mathematically it's quite rare that that happens, but let's also acknowledge that they are out there. But I believe even they should be addressed calmly and rationally, because when you do that, in many cases, it robs them of their power. But more importantly, we have to understand that increasingly customer service is a spectator sport.
Yeah.
So when you're responding to somebody like that, who you might consider to be a troll, yeah, I mean, kind of you're responding to them. But more importantly, you're going on record in front of tens or hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of other people looking on Facebook, Twitter, Yelp, TripAdvisor, what have you, discussion boards, forums, anywhere else. And so what you're essentially saying to the whole world is, we are taking the high road. We listen, we respond, we care about customers and customer feedback, and we're not going to pick and choose based on somebody's attitude or sort of their, you know, level of being unhinged. We're going to commit to answering everybody. Now, that does not mean that you get into a back and forth flame war with a crazy angry customer. That's not at all what I'm saying, but I think you should answer every customer once.
Okay, so at what point do you decide it's time to back off and just let it drop?
The second time. So there's a piece in my new book, Hug Your Haters, called Jay Baer's Rule of Reply Only Twice. And my Rule of Reply Only Twice says that you never, ever, 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 ever reply to a customer, good or bad, more than twice in a public forum, because it's either a waste of time or it's counterproductive. So if somebody is positive, and this happens, right, you get fans and they say, oh, we love you, and you answer back, oh, we love you too, and they answer a second time, oh, no, we really love you, and you come back a second time, no, we really love you too. If they come back a third time, right, and this happens on occasion,
yeah.
If they come back a third time, just walk away, right, because at that point you're wasting time. You've already high-fived twice. You don't need to do it a third time.
Right.
Clearly, it's more common in a negative scenario where somebody complains and says, you're the worst, and you answer back in public, as you should, we're sorry. Obviously, we've disappointed you in some way. How can I help? They come back a second time. I'm sure you can't help because you're just the worst. I don't ever want to talk to you again. You say, wow, well, it seems like we've really done something this time that really has stuck in your craw. Maybe we should talk about this in a more comprehensive or nuanced way. Could you send me a private message or call us or email us? And they come back a third time and say, I don't want to call you or email you. You're the worst. Just go away. At that point, just stop, just walk away, right? Asked and answered. You've given that person not just one, but two chances. You've given them alternate contact mechanisms. And again, you're on record with the whole audience of actually proving that you care and that you can be rational. The worst possible thing you can do, even though people love to celebrate companies that give it right back to angry customers, it's the worst thing you can do because it makes you look like a child. Exactly. And nobody wants to buy stuff from a child.
Exactly. I was just about to make a snide remark about the current Republican leadership debate, but I decided not to.
You know, there's a lot as a former political consultant. I don't know if you know this. That was my first job. I ran political campaigns. And so this current season is particularly interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And now having a book called Hug Your Haters, the worlds are colliding in a way that is not always delightful.
Yeah. It is quite entertaining, but we could easily get diverted on that and we won't. But it did, you know, the conversation, I guess this does sort of lead us into this whole issue of onstage versus offstage haters, which I thought was kind of a nice way of referring to it. It seems to me that an awful lot of companies have essentially trained people to be onstage haters, to complain in public. Would you like to comment a bit about that?
Well, one of the things that we talk about in business and in the book is that you have to be fast, right? You have to answer customers quickly because we're living in a right now world.
Yep.
And one of the things that is absolutely startling to me is in the research I did for the book, I discovered that the average amount of time it takes a business to reply to an email is 44 hours.
Still, that's crazy.
44 hours. It's almost 2 days, right? So, if you send somebody an email and then they get back to you for a couple of days, at some point during that period, you are probably thinking, they're blowing me off.
Yep.
And so what happens with a great degree of frequency now is a customer is perfectly willing to complain in private. They want to talk to you. Your business, and they're perfectly happy to talk to you via telephone or email. Mm-hmm. But then they send you an email, and they don't get an email back for 44 hours.
Or ever.
So like, well, wait a second. These guys aren't going to get back to me. Now they're twice upset. They're upset by whatever it was that upset them to begin with, and now they think you're blowing them off on email. So now they take it public, and they say, well, now I'm going to light them up on Yelp or Facebook or Twitter or what have you. So you have somebody who started off trying to complain in private, but because you were too slow, now they become a public nuisance.
Yep.
There's some research in the Netherlands that shows that in that country, 71% of the people who complain in social media initially complained on the phone or email. So we're kind of creating our own Frankenstein by being too slow with the legacy channels.
And yet what I see is it seems companies are so carried away with the joy of Twitter and Facebook and stuff. They're spending more and more money on that, and they're still not fixing the legacy channels. They're still not making their websites more comprehensive. They're not staffing their call centers adequately.
It's such a good point. It's because social care, and this isn't inherently a bad thing, but social customer service and social care is the new trend, right? And companies know, they don't need my research or your research to tell them this. They know that an increasing share of their customers are trying to reach out in social media because it's much easier to complain with one hand via a smartphone than two hands dialing the phone or typing an email. Mm-hmm. And that trend, of course, is going to continue. So there's lots of focus now in social care. There's also the belief that is less expensive to answer a problem on Twitter versus the phone, and that holds true.
But that only holds true if you can actually answer it in.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Absolutely right. But so what's happening? And I think we talked about the 44 hours to answer an email. The part of that I didn't tell you is that a year prior it was 36 hours.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
Email response time went from 36 hours to 44 hours in a year. And I don't know this to be true. I don't have this level of granularity on this particular data point, but I'm almost certain that what has actually happened in practice, and I see this in my own consulting business, is businesses say, geez, we've got to do more on Twitter, so let's take some people off of email. Mm-hmm. And put them on Twitter. So what happens is you're faster in social media, but you're slower in the legacy channels. Or let's take somebody off the phone and put them on Facebook, or off the phone and have them answer Yelp reviews or whatever. And so instead of actually adding resources, we're just moving resources. And so that's exactly what happens. You get slower in the legacy channels while you get somewhat faster in the new channels. And so you're not really fixing the problem. You're just moving the problem.
Absolutely. What, you know, I had this same issue. My previous business, Web Mystery Shoppers, basically did usability testing of websites largely. And I found it, and still find it, mind-blowing that there are all these companies that don't want to bother doing usability testing. And it seems to be the same sort of thing here, that there's a very obvious case that if you provide service that solves people's problems quickly, they're going to be happy, your business is going to do better. And yet companies are very, very reluctant to invest adequately in this. Why is that? And how can we change that?
Well, business has had it really easy for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the entirety of the history of business, the overwhelming majority of customer interactions have been in private.
Mm-hmm.
So face-to-face, telephone, email, fax, letter, all of the customer complaints and customer service issues and all of that has been in private forever,
yeah.
Forever, until very recently. So if you think about how business has evolved, the resources allocated to customer service and customer experience were based on the fact that there were no actual financial incentives to be great at customer service, and there were no financial disincentives to be terrible. Because if you were great, well, that customer might tell a few friends, oh, I got great service from these guys. And if you were terrible, they might tell a few friends, oh, they were terrible. But the individual customer who you either pleased or displeased had no amplification engine. And so if you think about this from a Freakonomics perspective, right, that there really was no actual reason financially to spend a bunch of extra incremental dollars to be disproportionately good at it. There just was no reason to do it,
right,
other than just we believe in this and this is the right thing to do, quote unquote. Now, however, with customer service and customer interactions largely moving to a public model, there are manifest reasons why companies should invest more money to be great at it, because they will be literally benefit from public view of those great customer service moments, and the penalty they pay for not being good goes up as well, because customers can now complain about how they were treated in social media and beyond, and it creates this amplification effect. And so the underlying economics of why you would invest in customer service beyond just the, you know, we have to answer the phone, but why you'd invest to be good have changed entirely. I mean, not even a little bit, like entirely. That's why what I talk about in the book is that customer service is being disrupted in the exact same way and by the same things that marketing was disrupted. Social media, millennials, and mobile. It's the same story, right? It's just that now that same story is being applied to customer service where previously it was applied to marketing. And that's why I say that customer service really is the new marketing, because now it's public. You can use great service as a differentiator. You can use it as a calling card. You can use it as what sets you apart from other companies in your category, but you do have to invest to do that. And look, the reality is that for decades and decades and decades and decades, customer service has been a necessary evil, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that also explains your comment about not having had to deal with it. Explains why even now monopolies or quasi-monopolies like utilities still have the worst customer service rankings. It's because they know you don't have a choice.
What's the downside?
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, what are you going to do? You're gonna light candles? Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Knock yourself out, man.
You also made the comment in the book, essentially, that it doesn't matter what your competitors are doing. Your customers are being trained to have expectations based on what I call the Amazon effect, which is basically looking at the best in the world and how they handle it. Would you like to elaborate a bit about that?
So there's some fascinating research from Bain that I'm sure you've seen that says that 80% of businesses say that they deliver exceptional customer service. 8% of their customers agree.
Right.
And that in and of itself is remarkable, but it actually makes sense when you unpack it a little bit, because when you ask a company, are you great at customer service, what they will think of is their competitive set. And they'll say, sure, we're better than these other guys.
Mm-hmm.
But when you ask a customer, is this company great at customer service, they don't think about the other companies in that category. They think about all the companies in the world. And so if you say, hey, are you great at customer service? The company says, yeah, we're better than the other plumbers in town. And the customers say, well, no, they're terrible because they're by no means Zappos or Southwest or Nordstrom or Ritz-Carlton. And so it doesn't matter. What I hear from companies all the time, especially on the consulting side of my business, is, well, why would we need to put this kind of resources into customer service or customer experience to be great at it because nobody else in our category is? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, because it doesn't matter whether anybody in your category is. Your customers are buying stuff from the best companies in the world, and they are training your customers what's possible. It's not like customers are going to say, well, it's okay that their customer service is only mediocre because they're in blank industry.
Although, if we think of your plumber's example, that's one where you don't really have global competition, right? You need a plumber. It's got to be someone who can get to your home or your office. So in a way, that's a less powerful argument in some industries, I would think.
In some industries it is, but if you think about related industries, so let's just say in my small town here, there's a bunch of plumbers, there's a bunch of locksmiths. Mm-hmm. Well, there's one locksmith that specializes in 24-hour service.
Yeah.
And so if I call the plumber, he's like, yeah, we can't get you till tomorrow because we're closed. Well, what I'm going to think is, well, wait a second, the locksmith guy who's basically in the same business will come at 3 a.m. What's your problem? I don't think about the plumber in the context of other plumbers. I think of the plumber in the context of adjacencies.
So essentially the risk to them is they're setting themselves up for a new competitor who comes in and gets the customer service thing.
That's right.
Somebody's
going to do it. This is the exact same story with utility. Somebody is going to do this in every category. The same way that some company in every category will embrace useful marketing, mm-hmm. some business in every category will say, you know what? We're going to make customer service our competitive advantage. We're going to offer similar products and services at similar prices, but we're going to be better on the back end, and that's going to be our thing. Somebody is going to do that. It's just a matter of time. So you can either say that's going to be us, or you can watch somebody else do it, and then you're going to have to compete on something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Actually, just your mention of utility, I just wanted to briefly flip back to that, and then we'll come back on topic. But one of the things in utility that you had mentioned, and for anyone who's listening to this, I'll put up a link to our previous interview on that. It was this whole notion of interruption advertising, that people are getting these ads thrust in their face that aren't useful and just get in the way. And theoretically, that should be diminishing, and yet I see that increasing. Why? I mean, obviously, at some level it works, right? So why are more companies not embracing both customer experience and utility?
I think they are, actually. It's just that the difference is, by definition, utility wins hearts and minds one at a time or a few at a time.
Yeah, okay.
You can't eat on utility alone. It doesn't reach enough people at the same time or fast enough to sort of be the lead sled dog in a marketing initiative.
Okay.
It always has to be the second or the third sled dog. So I think what you're seeing is a lot of companies doing it, but it sort of flies under the radar because they're not putting promotional dollars around it. And that's the biggest challenge. It's not so much that companies aren't adopting utility, because they really, really are. It's that they aren't using one of the other axioms in that book, which is to market their marketing. What they should be doing is spending TV, radio, print, outdoor, trade show, public relations dollars to promote their useful marketing instead of using those same dollars to promote their crappy product.
Okay, that makes
sense. So the example I talked about in the book is the sit or squat application.
Yeah, I quote that one a lot.
So Sit or Squat is a mobile app crowdsource that tells you whether or not a public restroom is sketchy or not. It's pretty useful, right? So that's a great example of utility. You know, they're not selling toilet paper directly, but indirectly they are. What Charmin should be doing, instead of making cartoon bears and doing TV commercials about that, is they should take some of that TV inventory and say, hey, we have this amazing application called Sit or Squat. We built it for you. It's free.
Right.
They should be using their traditional interruption marketing to promote their utility instead of using their traditional interruption marketing to promote cartoon bears. They're not doing that yet. And one of the reasons that's not happening is that and this is a little bit inside baseball, but in enterprise organizations right now, the company, the people in the companies that are making utility are typically on the content marketing team. Mm. The people who are are doing the advertiser on the brand team. So it's a different department. It's different personnel. It's different budgets. It's different objectives. They're just not synced up yet. And that's why even though utilities are being created, you don't see them out in the populace as much as you might because they're just not quite there yet. So it takes time, but it is coming. It is coming.
I hope so. So that brings up, actually, you mentioned something else that I wanted to ask you about with reference to the new book, which is the whole cross-silo issue in terms of resolving problems. Because I think that's also often where problems occur, is that you have one team that's answering the calls and trying to resolve things, but at a certain level, they can't solve the problem, and then the ball gets dropped. How should companies be handling that? What are some of the best practices to make sure that complaints are dealt with properly?
Well, one of the big problems is when you've got people who complain in multi-channels is that the software doesn't cross channels. The state of omni-channel customer service software is not where it needs to be. Because in practice, you've got social listening software that governs Facebook, Twitter, Yelp, TripAdvisor, et cetera, and then you have legacy customer service software that handles phone and email. Now, there are very, very smart people and very terrific companies that are solving that problem as we speak from a lot of different angles, trying to be the single point of truth for customer service in any environment. But it's really hard. It's a real challenge to do that. And so right now, what happens is you reach out to somebody on the phone, and then you go on Facebook, and they have no idea who you are, and there's no account history, and it's almost like dealing with two companies. And it's a real problem. So some of it's software, some of it's organizational, because you've got the social media team, quote unquote, doing social care, and you've got the customer service team, quote unquote, doing phone and email. So some of it's operational, some of it's software. But the nice thing is that I think companies realize pretty quickly where that bottleneck is. It's just trying to solve it. And one of the biggest challenges in solving it is that it's almost like adopting, a big CRM or an ERP or some other, massive software package. I mean, to roll it out while you're doing customer service is like pinstriping a car while it's moving. Because you can't be like, okay, we're not taking any calls for 2 weeks while we, plug in this new software.
Right.
It's just, there's a lot of detail there that is really, really hard at the enterprise level, which is why I really feel like not only from a utility standpoint on the marketing side, but also on the customer service, customer experience side, small and mid-sized businesses have such an enormous advantage.
Yeah.
Because they don't have to unscramble all these legacy omelets that they're, shackled with.
Mm-hmm. Certainly small ones. I think, often I see where things do fall down actually is within mid-sized business, because the large ones have invested at least to try and make sure they're dealing with it. The small ones can deal with it easily because it's just a few people involved. It's when they're in that mid-size where it suddenly means they've got to start making serious investments in an area they haven't had to worry about before.
Yeah, that's a really astute point. I think sometimes those companies, as they grow from small to mid-size, realize that they have to do this with systems now, right? You can't just cult of personality this, right? You can't just say, well, we're going to rely on the fact that everybody likes us and, we've got this great corporate culture or whatever the circumstances are. Now it has to be flowcharts and spreadsheets and software and, accountability and those kind of things. And that is really disruptive. I mean, it is very, very challenging. Having started a number of companies myself, the move between, we can kind of run this as a big family to we don't know everybody who works here now. And, we got lots of management is really hard. It is the hardest thing in business to go from small to medium.
Yeah, I think so. One of the things I really enjoy about your books is you often have really interesting, great examples of companies that are doing interesting things. And one of the ones that struck me, and offhand now I don't remember which airline it was, but one of the airlines where they essentially did real-time checking to find out if people had left things behind on the plane and try and track them down while they were still in the airport. Can you talk a bit about that example?
Absolutely. It's from KLM, the Royal Dutch Airlines, who I think are just extraordinary at customer service and customer experience. They really are world leaders. And I'm going to tell you two stories about that. The first is how they became so good at social media customer service. And they have 150 full-time people just doing Twitter and Facebook support. 150 people. And look, KLM's a big airline, but they're not you know, they're not Delta. They're a Delta partner, but they're not, you know, they're big, but they're not that big. 150 full-time people, 24 hours a day. They answer in 14 different languages. So if you tweet them in Turkish at 3 in the morning, they'll tweet you back by 3:15 in Turkish.
Wow.
Last year, they sold $25 million worth of airline tickets. Essentially on accident. They're not a sales group. They're not a revenue group. They are, in fact, a customer service group. But in the course of doing customer service, like, oh, yeah, here's a link to a flight you're looking for. They sold $25 million worth of tickets, right? So great service can pay. But what's interesting about that story is that they didn't have some sort of like cultural epiphany. They didn't read Hug Your Haters because it wasn't written yet. They didn't read your amazing book. They didn't do any of those things. They got here because of a volcano. And you may remember, I guess it was 5 years ago now, there's that giant volcano in Iceland of all places, and it created this like monster ash cloud that shut down all the flights in Europe. Like the whole continent was like no flights. And KLM flies all across continental Europe, and their hub in Amsterdam is really a popular way station. So you go like Warsaw to Amsterdam to whatever. That's kind of their thing. And so they literally had thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of passengers stranded. Like, how do I get to Warsaw? How do I get out of Warsaw? I mean, because there's no flights. And so they called an emergency staff meeting and said, well, what are we going to do? Because they had, like, this enormous tsunami of customer complaints and questions. And they said, well, we got two options. We can either try and triage this and figure out who's got the most acute problem, who has the most frequent flyer miles, you know, that kind of thing, and just sort of try to answer people based on some preconditions like that. Or we can just find a way to add resources and answer everybody. But let's remember, if we answer everybody, we can never go back. Like, you can't put that genie back in the bottle. You can't say to your customers, hey, here's our story. We deliver exceptional customer service during times of volcano. Like, you can't do that, right? You know, otherwise we're mediocre, but during volcano, we step it up.
Yeah.
And so their VP of commerce said, you know what? Screw it. Answer everybody. So it was all hands on deck. So they got all kinds of card tables and laptops. And the good news is they had the personnel because pilots couldn't fly, flight attendants couldn't attend, baggage handlers couldn't handle. They had all these people, right? So they just said, okay, just answer everybody. And they did. And that was the beginning of their program, which is now world class.
Yeah.
One of the other things that they do, and you mentioned it, is they really allow their team members to work off a script. If somebody sees an opportunity to do something different, they say, just go do it. Don't ask permission. Just deliver exceptional customer experiences without permission, which I think is an amazing concept and one that more companies should adopt. And so, like many airlines, they had this deal where if you left something on the plane, the flight attendant or the cleaning crew would come through, find your headphones in the seat pocket, literally put a post-it note on it and say, this was in seat 18C on flight 62, and put it on a desk. No, not a metaphorical desk, an actual desk in the crew room in the airport. And then on the customer side, the passenger side, if you tweeted and said, I left my headphones, they'd send you a link to a really, really, really detailed, too detailed actually, way too long, super long form, that you'd fill out on the website and submit it. And then on the back end, some poor soul would take all these online forms and walk over to the desk and try and like match it up and then send the stuff back. It was just, you know, this is not a good system. But this is actually how they handled it for years, and most airlines still handle it.
Yeah.
Well, one of their team members was like, look, this is insane. There's a better way. And so she said, look, she was on maternity leave, so she kind of had like a weird job share thing going on. She said, look, if somebody leaves something on a plane, don't put it on the desk. Just let me know. Just send me a text message. And so she'd just walk around the airport with an iPad, and a flight attendant would say, headphones in seat 18C on flight 72. She'd look it up on the passenger manifest, realize that, hey, that passenger's still in the airport because they're connecting to Brussels, and would just walk over to the gate and give them the headphones. And so now you've got this circumstance where people are getting their stuff back before they even know they left it. And you want to talk about an amazing customer experience that creates loyalty and advocacy and all the good stuff that we're trying to achieve.
Yeah,
that's it, right? If somebody hands you headphones you didn't even know you lost, the chance of you flying KLM again are approximately 143%.
Yeah, for sure. And in fact, it would be cheaper, I would think, for KLM to handle because they don't have all the process of having to study these forms and figure them out and then mail
mailing,
things to people.
Mailing classes, of course. Yeah,
that's cool. Are there any other particularly interesting examples from the book that, I know it's hard, it's like saying choose your favorite baby, but yeah, any others that you'd like to bring up?
One that I really like because I think it's so deceptively simple, and I know you've done a lot in the Secret Shopper world, is from Le Pain Quotidien. And they have a chain of bakeries and cafes. There are about 200 locations, 220. They're based in Brussels, ironically, but lots of locations in the U.S. as well. And their director of customer experience, Erin Pepper, when she started there a couple years ago, she said, my goal is to get triple the number of complaints. I want to increase complaints by threefold. Which is so counterintuitive, right? You're like, wait, what? What are you talking about? But she understands that every complaint is illustrative. Every complaint is informative. Every complaint allows you to get better. And the customers who are dissatisfied but don't take the time to complain are what kills businesses, right? That's why I say in the book, haters are not your problem. Ignoring them is.
Yes.
So they went and audited all their customer touch points and found all these different ways to nudge customers to provide feedback, trained their servers to ask customers to provide feedback, table tents in the restaurant, signage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a really great initiative, and I think something that everybody should mimic. But it's how she handles actually negative complaints when they do get them, I think, is really terrific. So if somebody gives them a negative review, and for them it would be because of the, you know, they're in restaurant business, so it would be Yelp, TripAdvisor, Urban Spoon, Facebook, Google reviews, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So she answers them all in public, as you should, and uses the regular Hug Your Haters playbook to do that. But then what she does next is crazy. So she waits a couple hours usually, and this is somebody who leaves a 1 or 2 star review. And then she answers them in public, waits 2 hours, and then answers them again in private using one of the private messaging functions that's typically available on most of those sites. She says, you know, I've been thinking, I just answered you in public, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but I've been thinking, and, you know, you're a particularly perceptive customer. You see things that other people simply do not see.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have a gift for this. You really do. So what I'd like to do, with your permission, I'd like to send you 2 gift cards per month. And with each of those gift cards, I'd like you to visit a different Le Pain Quotidien location. And upon the completion of your visit, I'd like you to click this link and fill out this very, very detailed survey of your experiences, because you understand what we're trying to accomplish here. I know you weren't happy this time, but you really understand detail, and we need that kind of experience. Would you do that for me?
Brilliant.
It totally works. She has 200 Secret Shoppers now filling out detailed surveys every month. Total cost of that program, gift cards. Now, you know as well as anybody what it would actually cost to run a program of that magnitude through a consultancy, and it would be a hell of a lot more than gift cards.
Yes.
It's just a brilliant, brilliant way. She has successfully turned hate into help, and I think that's pretty amazing.
That is beautiful. I love that example. Well, I think we're nearing the end of our time here. Is there anything that you wish I had asked you and I haven't?
One thing we didn't talk about specifically is that this book is not just my advice. This book is based on a massive research project that I conducted with Edison on the science of complaint. So everything that I tell you to do in this book is based on actual math and science and a study of consumer behavior. And I think that's really important. There's lots of charts and graphs and things like that in the book. There's a poster in every book. Every book includes The Hatrix, which is a poster of all kind of key data about online and offline complainers and how you handle them. So I'm really proud of the fact that you know, we put real math against this, not just anecdote. And the other thing you nodded to it, and I appreciate it, is that the stories in this book are really carefully cultivated. So there are big company stories and large and small company stories. There's B2C and B2B. There's American and global. Spent a lot of time trying to not tell the same stories that everybody else tells, but tell interesting different stories that are relevant to everybody. So if you have customers, you will get something out of this book. It doesn't matter what size organization you're from.
No real need to summarize here. Just get his book and read it if you have any doubts about the value of providing better social customer service and, as he puts it, hugging your haters. A little update for those of you who are curious. My book, People Shock, is now in the hands of the layout guy. Yay! All the writing's done, the editing's done, the proofreading's done. Now it's his turn. And then once I get that back from him pretty shortly, I will probably dragoon a couple of sharp-eyed people into doing a final proofread with me before it goes to actual publication. And the plan right now, I hope we're going to be able to stick with it, is to launch the second week of May. And we better stick with it because I've already got some commitments to do podcasts then and some guest posts. And actually, if you have any other podcasts that you listen to regularly and you think that they might be interested in the topic of customer experience and why the people factor matters more than ever as we become more automated, please either just email me, Tema@frankreactions.com, or contact that show's host and let them know that you think PeopleShock would be a good fit for their audience. Also, if you haven't already done it, I'd urge you to go sign up for the PeopleShock Insiders list at http://bit.ly/PeopleShockFirst, all written out as words and no spaces. Insiders get sneak previews of the book and bonus materials to help you manage your business better and improve customer experience, and you'll get invited to the launch party, which we've begun planning. That's it for today. If you didn't get a chance to hear last week's episode with Dan Weber of iTrax, where he was talking about doing customer research using mobile phones, you might want to go check that out. It's available at frankreactions.com/66. And of course, if you have any feedback for me, I would love to hear it. I'd also love it if you'd pop over to iTunes and leave me ratings and reviews. And if you want to reach me directly, you can email me, tema@frankreactions.com, or find me on LinkedIn or on Twitter, simply @TemaFrank, or give me a call at 1-866-544-9262. That's it for today. Chat with you again next week. Bye!